M580. I'm Craig Cohen. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry. Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Thomas Kilbride says the 18th Circuit Court in DuPage County and the First Circuit in Deep Southern Illinois will join the pilot project to allow enhanced media coverage in trial courts. The court will issue today to include the two circuits in the plan that lets reporters use cameras and other recording devices in courtrooms. Illinois Public Radio's Brian O'Keefe spoke with Kilbride about the cameras in trial court project yesterday at the Illinois News Broadcasters Association convention in St. Louis.
You know, when we started talking about enhanced media coverage in trial courts, one of the things that was the tenor of the conversations was about local media covering their court trials in their community. What we're also seeing, though, is organizations like True TV, In Session, coming in. Are you concerned at all about that changing the dynamic for this pilot program?
Well, I haven't had a lot of track record experience with that yet. Our communications director, again, Joe Tiber, worked with True TV on a trial that took place in Henry County earlier this calendar year, and it seemed to work well, and they do have a fair amount of experience, not just dealing with the courts, but also from the media perspective of lining up the coverage, and of course they have a lot of equipment that works extremely well, and they were able to pool that and make it available to the local media in the Quad City area outside of, well, covering Henry County.
So I talked with a judge in DuPage County who was involved in this committee, and one of the study committee, and one of the things that he mentioned was there was a sense among the judges that this is coming. This is going to be implemented statewide, and they need to get on board and start working through some of the bugs, for lack of a nicer way to put it. Mm-hmm. Is it your sense that this pilot project is going to lead to a permanent change?
Well, I really can't speak to that at this point. I mean, the project is what it is, and it's a developing, evolving one, and the success of it now is going to dictate how well it goes in the future, and I'm not able to predict what's going to come in the future.
I know judges don't like to think in the hypothetical, but I'm going to offer you one anyway. What could happen that could derail this? What are you concerned about?
Well, I think we're concerned about the issues that folks have talked about for decades now that have been problems in other court cases where it's disruptive, it's theatrical, it somehow jeopardizes the rights of participants in the trial to a fair hearing is really, and the decorum of the courtroom has got to be maintained at all times. So, you know, the easiest example is people use the O.J. trial, the O.J. factor, and I guess that's maybe the item to point to.
The Supreme Court has approved a number of circuits for the pilot project. Do you feel like you have enough for the pilot project, or is this pilot project eventually going to blanket the state?
Well, again, I don't know how it'll evolve, but I think the number is right for where we are as far as a pace, because each one of these circuits that have come online, it's always been preceded with a workup, if you will, of media meetings to get the media organized among themselves to interact with the circuit judges. And in many cases, as you know, in DuPage, for example, there was an in-house process of study and review by the circuit judges, the committee they established, including judges, lawyers, and members of the media. So it's taken its own pace, and I think we are where we ought to be at this point.
That's Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Thomas Kilbride. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Brian O'Keefe. Kilbride spoke at the Illinois News Broadcasters Association convention yesterday in St. Louis, where he accepted the group's Illinoisan of the Year award. A canal that provided a shortcut between the Illinois and Mississippi rivers was basically obsolete by the time it was completed. Yet it also influenced construction of the Panama Canal. Illinois Public Radio's Rich Egger reports as he spoke with an author of a new book about the Hennepin Canal.
The waterway is the subject of the new book, Voices of the Hennepin Canal, Author Bill Griffin grew up near the canal in northern Illinois and has been interested in it since he was a child. Construction of the Hennepin lasted from 1892 to 1908. Griffin says concrete was used to build the navigation locks and dams. He says it's the first time this was done in the U.S.
It's a methodology that still is used today, but in more modern form. This led to the same techniques applied to the Panama Canal, same techniques applied today to the Mississippi River, Illinois River, Ohio River, and so on. It's the same process of it had to be a continuous pour over a 24-hour period, or the length of time it took to pour a particular section.
And that's, I guess, what makes this project really stand out is it's the first time this technique was used, and it's proven to be such a good technique that it's still used today.
Yeah, it's still used rather than labor force now, where you have hydraulic jacks that actually ram the concrete rather than a person there with a rammer, almost like a toilet stool, flusher, a toilet bowl. Also, there was the feeder extended from the canal extended from the Illinois River to the above Hennepin to the Mississippi River west of Milan.
It's no longer used for interstate commerce. It's been a long time since it's been used for that. Why did they cease using it?
The time it took between when the first canal bill was put in, it was in the House in 1874, and when final authorization was granted in 1890, there were 17 canal bills, and not one was debated on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate, depending on who was in control. It was mainly the Democrats, which were opposed to it. They said there was nothing wrong with canals for states, but it had to be built by the states. And so any bottleneck is really in how the Congress does business. We tend to do these things on a piecemeal basis. By the time it was completed, it was virtually obsolete in terms of size. But interestingly enough, the locks, the abutments, the dams, the aqueducts are still in fine shape after 100 and some years.
So this was well built.
It was well built, except in one place, all without rebars, no steel, just concrete.
You mentioned you grew up not far from the canal, but in the course of researching this book, what did you learn about the canal?
I continued to be impressed by the amount of this. This was, first of all, this was, I don't know, however you compare it, however you cut it up, this was a massive undertaking in a 75-mile stretch and a 29.5-mile feeder to build that much.
Bill Griffin is author of Voices of the Hennepin Canal, Promoters, Politicians, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It's published by the Western Illinois University College of Arts and Sciences and the University Libraries. Rich Egger reporting.
Mezzo-soprano Cecilia Bartoli is famous for singing Mozart and Rossini, and now Agostino Stefani. Who's he? Well, Bartoli has worked at unearthing him.
I love to discover it. I'm the Indiana Jones of Baroque music.
Cecilia Bartoli on her new mission later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 24th of September, 2012. It's the birthday of Jim Henson in Greenville, Mississippi, 1936, who, as a college freshman, created a puppet show for a local TV station. And for it, he created the character Kermit the Frog, made him from his mother's pale green coat and a ping-pong ball. It was the beginning of The Muppets. It was in 1969. The show on public television, Sesame Street, was starting out, and they asked Jim Henson to join. It's the birthday of the poet Evan Boland, born in Dublin, 1944. She wanted to be a writer, and when she looked at the Irish literary tradition, she found almost no women poets in the ranks. So she set out to be one, writing about motherhood and about life in the suburbs. Evan Boland, who said, "Poetry is one of the most fugitive arts. It can be assigned to memory, taken and hidden in the mind, smuggled into smoky cabin back rooms, recited there, and then conveyed only by speech to another person. It is therefore the most likely to survive colonization." It's the birthday of F. Scott Fitzgerald, born in St. Paul, 1896, at Princeton University. He fell in love with a beautiful rich girl named Genevra King, who got engaged to somebody else because Fitzgerald did not have great prospects. He said later, "She was the first girl I ever loved, and she ended up throwing me over with the most supreme boredom and indifference." But it gave him an idea for a novel about a young man named Amory Blaine, falls in love with a beautiful blonde debutante named Rosalind, and then loses her because she doesn't want to marry somebody with so little money. Fitzgerald came back to his parents' home in St. Paul to write the novel. He pinned notes on the revision to his curtains, called the novel This Side of Paradise, and its publication in 1920 made him famous almost overnight, and it also won him the heart of a woman, Zelda Sayre, who married him that same year, 1920, in New York. 5 years later, Fitzgerald published his great masterpiece, The Great Gatsby, about a wealthy bootlegger, wears pink suits, throws extravagant parties, obsessed with winning back the love of his life.